From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Gauntlets are down, political daggers are out, the battle royal over President Bush's contested judicial nominees move toward a climax today on Capitol Hill. This morning, Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist brought to the floor the nomination of Texas Supreme Court Justice Priscilla Owen. She was one of 10 nominees Democrats blocked by filibuster in the first Bush term, one of those he has nominated again in term two. Democrats say the Bush nominees are out of the judicial mainstream. Republicans say they are the mainstream. This is the moment Washington has been bracing for. The moment when, if Democrats filibuster again, the Republican majority threatens to employ the so-called nuclear option, closing down the filibuster path on judicial nominees. Today, Bill Frist urged senators to vote on the Owen nomination.
Vote for the nominee, vote against the nominee. Confirm the nominee, reject the nominee, but in the end, vote.
And there were fighting words from Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid, who hearkened back to the Founding Fathers and the Hollywood filibuster in Frank Capra's 1939 classic, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Some in this chamber want to throw out 214 years of Senate history in the quest for absolute power. They want to do away with Mr. Smith, as depicted in that great movie, being able to come to Washington. They want to do away with the filibuster. They think they're wiser than our Founding Fathers. I doubt that that's true.
Tonight on Point, the final showdown over nominees on Capitol Hill and the great debate over what constitutes the mainstream of American jurisprudence. We begin tonight in Washington with perspective on today's Senate action. Maura Reynolds is congressional correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. She joins us now from Washington. Maura, thanks for being with us.
Nice to be with you, Tom.
So can you bring us up to speed at the end of day one of the end game here? What's the state of play? Where do things stand, Maura?
Well, we're having quite a talk-a-thon on the Senate floor, and I think we can expect more of that tomorrow. They're going to be holding 2 days of debate, full debate, and then we'll file a cloture motion on Friday, which means a motion to end the debate, and that will be the beginning of the parliamentary maneuverings towards the so-called nuclear option.
And the debate in these 2 days is both on the qualities, the attributes of the nominees, and on Senate procedure.
And on the checks and balances and the Constitution and on the history of the federal judiciary, and you name it, the whole gamut of issues is on the floor.
Now, does the fact that the debate is on now and we're moving toward potentially the so-called nuclear option, does it mean that the compromise path is finished, that it didn't work, that dinner between Frist and Reid was a bust, that John McCain and other moderates have failed in their effort to pull something out here?
Well, they've certainly been putting a lot of work into trying to find a compromise even today. There were at least three large closed-door meetings and countless other one-on-one meetings between the moderates and traditionalists who are trying to derail this train wreck. And they say they're going to continue meeting tomorrow. Any number of them today have said that there's still time before the confrontation reaches a climax next week, and they're not going to give up.
Maura, does Bill Frist have the 50 votes he needs, plus Vice President Dick Cheney, to shut off the filibuster option for judicial nominees?
No one really knows, and it's perfectly possible that Bill Frist doesn't know. There are a number of senators who are playing very coy, including with their own leadership, and it's a toss-up. The margin, if Frist thinks that he has it, is one or two at best.
And if it goes to the nuclear option, that would be in one of the first days of next week?
What they're saying now is that they're expecting it would be on Tuesday.
And if that happens, paint the sequence of events that would then unfold, Maura Reynolds.
Well, bear with me a bit because it's a bit tedious.
Okay.
But it's all sort of parliamentary maneuvering.
It's our national life laid on us.
Yeah, okay. Wouldn't necessarily make sense to the uninitiated, but in essence, Bill Frist would make a motion that they've debated this nomination long enough and ask the chair, who would be expected to be Vice President Cheney, to make a ruling that after a certain number of hours of debate, whatever had taken place up to that point, that senators should have the right to decide whether to move to a vote. And Vice President Cheney is expected to say, to agree to the motion, the Democrats are expected to object, then the Republicans are expected to vote on whether to basically remove the Democratic objection, and then hold a vote on whether to move to a vote, which would be a 51 majority vote, and then they would actually hold a vote on the nomination. So there would be a series probably of at least two and probably three votes that would culminate in the nomination vote on Priscilla Owen. And what all of that would do effectively is codify a new procedure for dealing with judicial nominations.
Would the balance of the filibustered, previously filibustered nominees then be put up and voted presumably through by Republicans?
Presumably, yes. Then they would bring up all the rest of the contested nominations.
Is there any question that the Republicans have a majority for the nominees? Might some of the moderates who have been working behind the scenes lately object to some of these nominees or not?
Well, Senator Frist has 55 Republicans in the chamber. He would have to lose, and Vice President Cheney would be a swing vote. So he needs to lose the support of six Republicans in order to lose the 51 votes that he says that he needs to do this.
Any visible chance of that on any of these nominees?
Well, you know, there's only two of them that are on the record saying that they would support the Democrats in this. And as for the other four, he probably has at least two, but like I said earlier, you know, no one knows about the other two. And there's lots of people attending these meetings, but there's also a lot of people not really putting their foot down where they're going to stand on this.
And finally, Maura, if it goes this way, then the filibuster option is cut off for the future. When and if, and could be soon, the Senate's looking at Supreme Court justice nominations.
That's correct. It would, Republicans say, apply only to judicial nominations, but that would include Supreme Court nominations. And as we all know, Chief Justice Rehnquist is quite ill at the moment. He is expected to step down fairly shortly, and that would create a vacancy on the court.
And there's the big game, and just the beginning of that big game. Maura Reynolds, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
It's a pleasure.
Maura Reynolds covers Congress for the Los Angeles Times. She spoke with me from Washington. We are talking tonight about the historic battle unfolding in Washington over judicial nominees. You can join the conversation. What is at stake in the Senate's great debate over the judiciary right now? What do you expect in a top-level American judge? Do these nominees fit the bill? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Jonathan Turley, a nationally recognized legal scholar, essayist, and professor of law at George Washington University. Jonathan Turley, thanks for being with us tonight.
It's a pleasure.
With us from Malibu, California, is Douglas Kamek, professor of public interest law at Pepperdine University. He served as assistant attorney general under Presidents Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush. Douglas Kamek, thank you for joining us tonight.
Nice to be with you.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you. Thanks for being here.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guests.
So here we are, a fine kettle of fish. Jonathan Turley, we really want to talk about the judicial mainstream, who's in, who's out, what it means, if it's the right yardstick tonight. But we've got to look for just a moment at what's going on in the Senate. What do you see as at stake in this handful of days?
Well, you know, the problem with the removal of the filibuster rule, if it occurs, is that it will definitely change the character of the Senate. I don't see any really persuasive arguments on the other side.
Even if the removal is just in the case of judicial nominees?
Even just in judicial nominees. You know, the Senate has largely been insulated from this red state, blue state politics that we've seen in the last few years. It was designed to be insulated. It was designed to give minority interest an enhanced role for various constitutional reasons. We now see sort of politics catching up with the Senate, and I think that, quite frankly, it will change the character of the Senate. And I think that's why you have some Republicans, particularly more senior Republicans, either saying that they're definitely going to vote to preserve the filibuster or that they're still on the fence, despite tremendous pressure coming from the White House.
Doug Kamek, let me ask you on that front, do you see the Senate being fundamentally changed if the so-called nuclear option is taking? Will it no longer, as it's famously been described, be the saucer to cool the coffee, to cool the tea?
I don't, because I think the statement that this is nuclear in dimension is overstatement. That the filibuster as applied to judicial nominees is wrongful because it deprives the Senate of its character in a true sense. Its character is to perform a constitutional function of advice and consent, and it's not doing that now. And it's doing, it's not doing its job in disregard of the role that's anticipated for it by the framers, and therefore it's doing damage both to the presidency in terms of the president's role in nominating and selecting individuals, and it's doing damage to the judiciary insofar as it's leaving the courts understaffed and incapable of meeting their dockets. So I think it's possible to change this rule or to change the interpretation of the rule as the Senate has done several times before without anything nuclear happening and with the Senate being better for it and not lessened.
Big difference of perspective right there. Jack Beatty, there's going to be a lot of talk about the Senate and its past and future over the coming days. We're really going to look more at the mainstream issue in looking at nominees tonight. But first, before we go to break, your thought on the Senate issue here.
Well, you know, the Democrats would come back to Professor Kamek and say, look, we voted for 95% of the president's nominees. Under Bill Clinton, 60 nominees were held up in the Judiciary Committee. They did not receive advice and consent. They did not even get a vote on the committee, much less a vote on the floor. And the Democrats were saying, you know, we're not doing anything like that. We're not holding up that many judges. And we have, under the rules of the Senate, as they exist, we have the power to do this. The Republicans are going to have to change the rules.
Well, that will be unfolding tonight. We're looking at that historic battle over judicial nominees on Capitol Hill, moving now toward a climax. And we're looking at the debate over what now constitutes the mainstream of American jurisprudence. You can join us tonight. The Democrats say President Bush's filibustered nominees are outside the judicial mainstream, that they are radical ideologues. Republicans say no, they are in the mainstream. What do you think? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking tonight at the historic battle over judicial nominees going on right now on Capitol Hill. The showdown phase is with us. And we're looking at the debate over what now constitutes America's judicial mainstream. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you expect in a top-level American judge in terms of judicial record, in terms of temperament, in terms of politics? And what is at stake in the Senate's great debate over the American judiciary right now? We're joined tonight from Malibu, California, by Douglas Kamek, professor of constitutional law at Pepperdine University, former dean of law school at the Catholic University of America in Washington, former assistant attorney general under Presidents Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush. From Washington, by Jonathan Turley, professor of public interest law at George Washington University, a nationally recognized legal scholar. Jack Beatty is with us as well. Doug Kamek, if I may go to you first. We're going to hear some clips from the Senate floor today, from senators making their points. But the mainstream issue, this seems to be the yardstick that is held up by both sides, Republicans saying they're in, Democrats saying they're out. But give us a little background on this. Is this always the measure of a judicial nomination, whether or not he or she is in the mainstream?
Well, it has been a term that has been in play since Robert Bork's controversial nomination to the Supreme Court was rejected. It was rejected with the summary that he was out of the mainstream of judicial thought. I must say the mainstream is not well defined, and it depends on what part of the stream you're standing in. But this much is true. Throughout our history, presidents have considered the philosophy of the people that they have named to the court. So it's foolish to say that the Senate can't also consider philosophy. Washington did, Adams did, certainly, in preferring Federalists over Anti-Federalists. Lincoln told us when he campaigned that he wanted people who would overturn Dred Scott, Roosevelt in the progressive era for the New Deal, Ronald Reagan in the screening that we did for him when I was in the Justice Department. All of that's true. And there's nothing wrong with that. People, I think, fully understand that when they vote for presidents, they are voting for the people that he brings to the executive branch as well as the judicial.
And when you say presidents, Senates also consider philosophy, you're saying that as in addition to or as opposed to their mainstream position, in other words, they're free to graft in a new thread of philosophy if they feel it's important, even if it's outside the standard mainstream?
No, I think this mainstream is a catchphrase where people are somebody, when they say they're out of the mainstream, they don't like their philosophy. and that's something that they have made political statements with which they disagree. And here's where I'd like to draw a distinction. I think there's a distinction between selecting judges on the basis of kind of crude partisan politics, mm-hmm. counting up the outcomes in particular cases and whether or not you like a given outcome rather than another, versus a philosophy that says, that asks the legitimate question, what is the role of the judge in the American constitutional system? Is it to preserve the stability of law, the certainty of law, its neutrality, a respect for the separation of powers, a special respect for the decisions made by the legislative branch, or is it to substitute its will for those other entities? I think that's where the great divide is, and some people see judges as being more free and capable to set aside the judgments of the people made in legislative assembly, and others don't, and that's where this epithet or descriptor or whatever you want to call it of mainstream versus non-mainstream comes into play.
Mm. Jonathan Turley, you describe yourself as a pro-choice social liberal, but when you look at this lineup of waiting nominees, you say that for most of these Republican nominees, quoting you, Democratic opposition looks as principled as a drive-by shooting for most of them. But then you point to three and say, here there are real issues of mainstream or outside the mainstream. Take us into your thinking.
Well, first of all, there are of the 12 that are being held, and the number changes by who you ask, but there's about 12 nominations that are being held up. Four of those are in Michigan, and there's no real reason that I can see why they are being held, except that there's a turf war with the two Michigan senators. There's another gentleman out in Utah who I think was treated particularly shabbily. He was accused of practicing without a license when he had a perfectly good reason not to become a Utah bar member, as supported by the Utah bar presidents. And the Democrats have dropped their objections to them. I mean, when you really distill them down, you've got five principal controversial nominees. Of those, I thought that three of them had a plausible reason to be filibustered. The two that I did not, I would not argue they are within the mainstream in the sense that Bill Pryor, who I happen to know and I happen to like, is breathtakingly conservative. I mean, he is quite conservative on virtually every issue. But the reason I think that he is not worthy of a filibuster is that I think he has shown that he is prepared to set his views aside, which he did in the Ten Commandments fight in Alabama. He
with Justice Roy Moore there, the Alabama Supreme Court Chief Justice.
That's right, and he supported Roy Moore. But when Roy Moore refused to comply with the orders of higher courts, Pryor prosecuted him zealously. And Janice Brown has indeed made really inflammatory statements. But when I've looked at her opinions, I don't see a refusal on her part to yield to higher courts and to respect the process. The three that I think are problematic very quickly are, I think Priscilla Owen is problematic. I mean, it's not just that Alberto Gonzalez and other colleagues referred to her decisions as judicial activism. It's not just one decision. There's many decisions where her decision was singled out with that type of language.
Give us some other examples. We want to get a flavor for what's being seen as outside the mainstream or as off the
Owen's
reservation.
Well, Owen's principal problem is I think that when you look at the opinions, you really do see a refusal on her part to defer to the legislature, particularly on parental notification, which is ironic because I actually, even though I'm pro-choice, I actually I have sympathy with her position on parental notification.
This is in the case of minors seeking abortions.
That's right, mm-hmm. And I agree with her that parents, in my view, are not given enough participation. But that's not my decision. That's not her decision. The Texas legislature made the decision. And she has 12 decisions that really come across as a virtual refusal to acknowledge the legislative decision-making of the Texas legislature. And her conservative colleagues yielded to the legislature and said, look, it's obvious this is what they wanted. And I think it was obvious. And I think the safest definition of activism is when you resist or refuse to accept a legislative decision. The two other individuals are Haynes, who, as general counsel of the Department of Defense, played a role in the so-called torture controversy.
This is William Haynes.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And Haynes is accused of really silencing critics who in the Department of Defense who wanted to adhere to the Geneva Convention and supporting that memo and playing a critical role in it. And the final one is Myers, who was at the Interior Department known as someone with truly extreme views.
This is William Myers, the former mining lobbyist.
That's right. And he had pretty extreme views on the interpretation of environmental statutes. Those three nominees, in my view, did raise serious questions as to whether they are appropriate for that type of high judicial office.
Douglas Kamek, I want to get your response on all three of those in just a moment. But first, let's hear a voice from the floor of the Senate today. Here's Republican Senator Chambliss of Republican of Georgia in support of Priscilla Owen.
There are still people who want the United States Senate to reject her nomination to the federal bench because she's supposedly out of the mainstream in her legal reasoning. Out of the mainstream? The people of Texas obviously don't think she's out of the mainstream. In fact, I submit to you that in Texas and in the Fifth Circuit overall, she represents the mainstream of legal thought. I would imagine my friends on the other side who are filibustering this nominee would agree with me that the American Bar Association is an organization considered by many to be well within the mainstream of legal thinking in this country. The ABA rated Justice Owen as well qualified for the Fifth Circuit. That's the highest rating, and it's often called the gold standard in indicating the best possible qualifications to serve on the federal bench. By their opposition to Justice Owen's confirmation, my colleagues on the other side seem to be telling the ABA, don't bother with your rating, it just doesn't matter to us.
Senator Saxby Chambliss, Republican, Georgia, on the floor of the Senate today. Douglas Kamek, how about it? Jonathan Turley pulls out these three. And, of course, Priscilla Owen is first in line, but also the one, it sounds to me, he finds, and others, most objectionable. He says, as Alberto Gonzalez has written, she is, in fact, the kind of judicial activist that I heard you saying you didn't want to see on the bench. What do you think of that interpretation?
Well, I've talked with Judge Gonzalez about his former colleague, and I've also read his opinions about her. They disagreed in some of these parental notification cases, but there were other members of the Texas Supreme Court who joined either side of that debate. So I think it was one of these cases where statutory interpretation and reasonable minds could differ.
And yet he's attorney general. He worked closely with her. He was the top guy on the court, and he's got this complaint. Shouldn't that ring bells by your standard?
Well, he had a criticism in the context of a colleague, as a colleague, with regard to a particular case.
Not a minor. I mean, he called it an unconscionable act of judicial activism. That doesn't sound like a throwaway line.
Yeah, fair enough. But I will say that he has obviously said things with regard to Judge Owen far differently since and before. And with regard to whether or not she's in the mainstream or not, I think Senator Chambliss, makes a nice point. Justice Owen was returned to the bench by 84% of the vote in the last election that she faced in Texas. She got a well-qualified ranking from the ABA, which is the highest ranking available. She had the widespread support of Democrats and Republicans when she sought the office and continues to have that support today. So the fact that she had judicial disagreements in the performance of her function with colleagues who still like her and praise her for her intelligence and her even-handedness and her temperament seems to me to be not a disqualifier. With regard to Jonathan's well-stated comments with regard to the other
William Myers, William
nominees,
Haynes.
Mm-hmm. William Haynes and Myers, I would just point out that he raises legitimate criticisms that in part I would share with him, but I don't think they're the basis for filibuster. I think they're the basis for making up your mind about the character and intellectual qualities of these individuals and then to decide yay or nay as to whether or not they should go forward. I think that's the Senate's responsibility. And by the way, I bemoan the fact that this has been going on so long that the parties have been able to mutually injure themselves and therefore mutually injure the process. Republicans found alternative ways to bottle up nominations in committees, and now Democrats are bottling up on the floor. Neither practice is justifiable. But that kind of tit-for-tat argument has to stop, and I think this is the place where it stops. And I think there have been some nice developments coming out of this, namely the promise that people will not be bottled up in the future in committee, and they should not be filibustered on the floor, and that ought to be the rule.
But you can see why the Democrats might be chagrined at this all happening on the Republicans' watch. I mean, do you, like Jack Beattie, equate the bottling up in the committee during the Clinton administration with what the Democrats are doing now? Turnabout's fair play?
I think in a political sense, it is obviously turnabout. I think in a legal and constitutional sense, the injury has become more grave. Because once you have a nominee who clearly has the majority support of the Senate, and you're preventing a majority of the Senate from expressing its will, you're doing greater damage. And the damage is just getting greater all the time with regard to the needs of the other branches. So, yes, I think there's some political turnabout. And I guess my response is it has to stop somewhere. Now, would it have been nice if we could have suspended time and have no one in office for a period of time and set the rules in advance? Yes, but that's not realistic. So let's come to some reasonable rules at this point, and a reasonable rule that says, nominees will be considered and reported to the floor in a responsible period of time and then given an up or down vote is a good one.
Probably sounding more reasonable at this moment, though, to the majority party. Jack Beattie, I want to get you in here, but first let's hear from a Democratic senator on the floor today, Patty Murray, Washington State, speaking here against the confirmation of Priscilla Owen.
I have sat down with Priscilla Owen. I have asked her questions, and I have reviewed the record. And this is not about a person. This is about a record. It's about a record that is outside the mainstream on parental consent, which we've heard about. But not just that. It's about victims' rights, which any of us can be. It's about workers' rights. It's about a bias towards campaign contributions. We will be setting that record straight throughout this debate. But I think it's especially important for all of us to recognize that a record really says what someone will be and what decisions they will make about any one of us in this country in the future. And that is what I dispute, and that is what I strongly will be here on the floor later today when I have more time to outline, because we can all agree that lovely people deserve opportunities. But when it comes to our courts and when it comes to making decisions about us, our family, about women, about children, about rape victims, about workers, about the many things that can come before a court, a record really is what we have to look at and what we have to stand on.
Washington State Senator Patty Murray there talking about Priscilla Owen. Of course, Kay Bailey Hutchinson of Texas nearly broke down on the Senate floor today, speaking glowingly of the great character of Priscilla Owen. Jack Beattie, what are you making of all this? You've heard Secretary Chambliss there point out, he says 84% of Texans voted for Priscilla Owen. If that's not mainstream, what is? She's got the highest ABA rating. Why are we still arguing about who's mainstream and who's not?
Yeah, I just wonder about this mainstream. I even felt it back at the Bork time. I was definitely against Bork. But I did feel that there was an argument there that to be in the mainstream as a law professor or a judge means to be cautious, means to be sound, means not to be adventurous.
What's wrong with that when it comes to law?
Well, but then is that how law changes? How do you reflect the evolution in the law and in public opinion about the law? The trouble with sanctifying the mainstream as the criterion is that it freezes law to the past, to precedent. And society changes. The felt necessities of the times, as Justice Holmes said, change. There's an example of it in the 19th century. Lincoln appointed five justices. One, a Democrat, Stephen Jay Field, took the opposite position from Lincoln, who wanted his justices to respect, a legislative prerogative. Mm. And Field wouldn't do that, and he was a lone dissenter in striking down, trying to strike down state laws that on Reconstruction, on economic regulation, and the like. A lone dissenter. But lo and behold, his positions were, in time, the majority positions. By the end of his tenure, with his nephew, David Brewer, on the court, he represented the mainstream, and partly it was the mainstream because for 30 years he'd been banging away, making his laissez-faire arguments, and finally he got his way. So that's an example of someone who wouldn't accept, you know, the norms of the mainstream. We have to leave the legislation alone, and change with public opinion and help change public opinion.
Of course, you know, the big norm here that's really behind all this, I guess, abortion. And on that, we see public opinion, everything I see in the surveys for it, even though you know what's driving here, Jack, it's driving right against it. Jonathan Turley, I want to hear from you on all this in just a moment. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the historic battle over judicial nominees on Capitol Hill. We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the historic battle over judicial nominees on Capitol Hill and the great debate over what now constitutes America's judicial mainstream. You can join us tonight. What does a mainstream judicial profile mean to you? And should a mainstream profile be a prerequisite for judicial nominees? Does that shut off judicial innovation, or does it protect established precedents? How would you vote for Priscilla Owen, for Janice Rogers Brown? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jonathan Turley, I want to get you in here. There's been a lot said, beginning with, on Priscilla Owen, Douglas Kamek saying, well, you know, it's one rebuke by Alberto Gonzalez for her judicial activism, but look at the rest of it, as Sexy Chambliss laid out. And then Jack Beatty saying, maybe the mainstream measure is the wrong one. It kind of leaves things calcified. How do you respond?
Well, I think that it is true that our nomination process too often produces vanilla-flavored nominees. I mean, it's very ironic, quite frankly, that you know, the conservatives who adore Justice Scalia actually aren't appointing Scalias. I mean, most of the nominees appointed by the administration, in my view, are pretty unremarkable. I've supported up or down votes on virtually all of them on principle, but I must say that I think the quality of the nominees is not particularly high, and they're not appointing the future Scalias. Janice Brown, I think one of the reasons I hate to see her filibustered is because I don't mind someone stirring up things in speeches and raising provocative issues. It indicates that they're thinking outside the box.
Calling the New Deal a socialist revolution, she knows how to stir it up.
Yeah, she does. But, you know, I think that there's a certain healthy quality to that, and it may be the vices of an academic. But with Owen, I think it's a different issue. It's not just one opinion. There are 12 Jane Doe opinions. In my view, Owen's struggling to ignore what the legislature said.
What's a Jane Doe opinion? Sorry.
Oh, these are decisions in which the minor's identity is being left out.
I see. So all about minor abortion issues.
Right. And those opinions, to me, really do speak of activism. I mean, if there's a meaning to activism, you find it in those opinions. And it's ironic, you know, because I'm the author of the Parental Rights Amendment in Florida, which sought to increase the authority of parents in issues like parental notification. So if anything, I'm sympathetic. But that's not what the Texas legislature did. And in opinion after opinion, she seems to just be willfully blind to that intent.
And well, Jonathan, let me ask you, there seems to be a lot of Americans, clearly not all, but a lot who feel that America's courts have been a kind of a tool or avenue for social evolution in this country, whether it comes to equal education, equal opportunity, women's rights, and so on, not the calcified face that Jack referred to. And they fear all that being turned back now. So how does that come into play when you think about the mainstream, about vanilla, about activism versus its opposite?
Well, I think that the greatest danger for those people really is the backstory of this entire controversy. I've talked to a lot of senators since this thing began, and very few of them are actually talking about these Court of Appeals nominees in private. I mean, there's a sharp disconnect between what's being said publicly and what's privately being said. I mean, this is all about the Supreme Court, and it's about not the next nominee, because it's expected to be Chief Justice Rehnquist, but the possibility that this president could appoint people to replace Sandra Day O'Connor and possibly John Paul Stevens. That's one swing vote and one of the liberal votes.
Mm-hmm.
if the president could indeed replace O'Connor or Stevens, there's a host of doctrines, including Roe v. Wade, that are hanging in the balance of a 5-4 split. And that's a real issue. I think that what's on everyone's mind is really sort of Clarence Thomas. There's a feeling that the president could very well nominate Clarence Thomas. He's already said that he's one of his two favorite...
As Chief Justice, you mean?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And for conservatives, he's become an icon. For liberals, he's an icon. I mean, for liberals, you just as well appoint Pinochet. I mean, liberals, he is the ultimate symbol. Now, I think for Karl Rove's perspective at the White House, he wants to clear the decks to allow the president to appoint who he wants to be the next Chief Justice. And Clarence Thomas is the measuring standard. If the filibuster rule survives past the end of June, Clarence Thomas, I don't think, will ever see the inside of the Chief Justice's office.
So why are the Democrats testing it then? If that's really the big game, why don't they just let all of these nominees go through and save the filibuster for the Supreme Court debate?
Well, that's a good question, but I think that the Democrats do have well-based objections to some of these nominees. It's not all about the Supreme Court. I think for the Republicans, it's a large part about the Supreme Court. I think that for the White House, it's much to do with the Supreme Court. I think that Karl Rove views this as a fight that's going to have to happen, and he can pick the time. And he would prefer not to have the filibuster debate occur when there's a controversial Supreme Court nominee like Thomas on the floor. And so I think that from Rove's perspective, he views this as, look, this is going to hurt now, but it's going to hurt a lot more later, and let's just get over it.
And so the battle unfolds right now, the kind of pre-battle. Douglas Kamek, Jack Beatty, Jonathan Turley, stand by. I've been keeping callers waiting so long, I want to bring them in. Gene's calling from Eden, North Carolina. Hi, Gene, you're on the air.
Hey there. I've been watching this dance between Senator Reid and Senator Frist for a couple of weeks now, and I find it fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
The argument they're making, of course, Frist is trying to line himself up to run for president in 08, and Reid is doing his job to try to slow down the Republicans, but the argument, I think, over the rules is really irrelevant in this case. I think Frist has overplayed his hand. It comes down to this. If a judge of this importance, a federal judge, can't get a two-thirds vote in the Senate...
Or 60 votes, well, that's three-fifths now, I guess.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Then that judge, by definition, is not qualified to be a judge and should be withdrawn.
By whose definition, Gene?
Well,
because the Republicans are saying up or down, and they know they've got a simple majority.
That, but if you've got someone who says, the argument is specious, that the up and down vote is just it's like a mantra that's just being quoted over and over and over again. But think about it. If you've got a federal judge, don't you want to raise the bar on federal judges and not lower it to the lowest point you can get it to? And that's what they're doing right now.
Gene, stick with us for a moment, if you would. Hang with us. I want to put that to Douglas Kamek at Pepperdine. Professor Kamek, here's a citizen who says, gosh, these are important positions. I want these judges to be able to get 60 votes in the Senate. And if they can't, maybe they're not moderate enough.
Well, I think that's a reasonable position. It's just not what the Constitution provides for.
Who says? I mean, it's
well,
been working that way.
The text provides that a majority vote will be successful, and by the long tradition of the Senate, has been successful for the confirmation of judges. If he wants to have a supermajority requirement imposed upon the confirmation of judges, we can do that by Article 5 of the Constitution. And have that rule be applied uniformly. But
and you look back at all the earlier cloture votes around judicial nominees, and you don't see them as applying here.
I don't. Because I think you find Supreme Court nominations being approved by less than, certainly less than two-thirds. And for that reason, while the cloture votes could be a hidden way to implement that strategy, that's not what the formal requirement of the Constitution is.
Caller Gene in North Carolina, what do you make of that? If this was good enough for many judicial votes in the past, is it not good enough now? Are the issues so big now, the social issues before the country, that we need a higher bar?
Well, I think that what we're dealing with are people who have major plans to transform our government in ways it was never intended or foreseen when the Constitution was written. And yeah, maybe it's time to look at that and either amend the Constitution or to set the rules so that the filibuster is okay in cases where if you can't get 60 votes, then that's not that judge isn't good enough.
Gene, we hear you, and we thank you for your call. Jonathan Turley, how about it? Here's a concerned citizen who says, gosh, the issues are so big, I don't want this on a 51 vote margin here. I want that supermajority. Douglas Kamek says, well, too bad. The Constitution doesn't provide for it.
Well, I think that Doug's point is well taken. I mean, we have to start and ultimately end with what we agree to as a in the Constitution. I mean, the Constitution is a certain covenant between citizens. We agree to it, or at least our predecessors did, and we agreed to the only way to amend it. And we can't do that by default. I mean, we really signed a contract with each other when that happened. But having said that, the Constitution also clearly leaves the rules of the Senate to the Senate. Mm. And so, you know, there's that famous scene in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington where he stands up in the well of the Senate and says, and he's about to collapse, and he says, you know,
Jimmy
my
Stewart,
God,
yeah.
Either I'm right or I'm crazy. And I think that Frist is about to prove you can be both. I mean, Frist is right. The Republicans can change the rule. I don't think, by the way, that the constitutional ruling of the vice president that the filibuster is unconstitutional is correct. The Senate can set its own rules, and I don't think most federal judges would agree with that ruling. But ultimately, it doesn't matter because it'll come to a vote of the Senate, and they can set their own rules. Where I think that he's wrong...
Where does the craziness come in?
Well, I think that this is a real mistake because, first of all, I think that the president is going to sacrifice much of his legislative agenda. And I think it's actually quite telling that this president views the courts as perhaps his most lasting legacy. You know, the terrorism thing is going to be controversial. But I think this president understands that if he changes the Supreme Court particularly, that will be his lasting legacy.
And he'll sacrifice his legislative agenda because Democrats will bottle it up or he'll lose moderate Republicans?
I think they'll bottle it up. The Senate, I think that there's going to be a more significant effect than Doug does. While it just affects judges, the Senate has always really floated on a sea of collegiality. That is how things have gotten done in the Senate. And believe me, that sea will be as dry as a bone once the nuclear option is used. And I don't think that it is brinkmanship. I think it's real that something is going to be lost. And I think that's the reason you see some of these people like John McCain. And
so worried, so concerned.
Yeah.
I want to get another call here. Erica's calling from Boston. Hi, Erica. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. It's been a very interesting discussion. The comment that I had was related to what's really mainstream. I think I'm a lawyer, but I'm not a Supreme Court scholar or a constitutional scholar, and I'd have to say that for me, mainstream reflects the evolving nature of the law over the last 40, 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
That mainstream has become what is a as I look at decisions that have been important to me, both in my practice and simply as a citizen of the United States, I see that standards for what constitutes, for example, say, cruel and unusual punishment have changed and evolved. And what is mainstream now is much more morally relativistic than it might have been in the past. And I look at these nominees, and what I see is that they are, in fact, reactionary. I think it's interesting to call them activists, because what I hear as I listen to what their decisions are is reactionary and very well outside what I consider to be the mainstream.
This Janice Rogers Brown, California Supreme Court, again, once calling the New Deal a socialist revolution, not in a finding from the bench, but a comment in public. So you're saying a reactionary court here, not activist, and is that fair? Is that within the purview of courts to move this way and that, Erica, or does it all need to go one way?
Well, I don't know that it's quote unquote. I don't want to say that it's fair. I know that if I I think that if you look at judicial history and you look at the decisions of the Supreme Court, they in fact try to move mostly in one direction. Mm. That is, that they talk about evolving standards. They talk about, in their decisions, how our notions of what's just and right, fair, whatever, have changed and evolved. Like our whole notions of what constitutes privacy rights, what we're entitled to do behind closed doors, have changed dramatically. And I don't think if you asked any average citizen, do they really want those things to change, most people would say no. The people that I hear saying, yes, we want this to change, yes, we want the judicial activism mm-hmm. of the conservatives, are the people who want, say, for the judges to do what they tried to get them to do in the Terry Schiavo case.
Yep, we've got it, Erica. Thank you very much for your call. Douglas Kamek, let me put that to you. Is the country owed a kind of directional, progressive evolution from the bench? Erica's saying, look, these are rights we've won from the court over time. We shouldn't be turning back. And she raises the issue of is the move to turn back being really pushed by a minority within the majority?
I think America deserves to be the constitutional republic it was designed to be, and it starts with the first three words, we the people. We are our own governors. And yes, we have identified a number of places in the Constitution where we will check ourselves. We won't allow a majority to deny us freedom of speech, freedom of religion, the right to a fair trial. We won't allow a majority to impose cruel and unusual punishments. But by and large, when we want to be progressive, when we want to be dynamic, when we want to secure something new and think out of the box, it's up to us to do it. And it's up to us to convince our neighbors and friends in the legislative assembly that that's the right course. And really what the whole debate is about is the emphasis of that. Do you give emphasis to the people being their own governors, or do you expect to be pulled around and directed by a judiciary that wasn't elected, but that in fact decides to set aside the judgments of the people? Mm. I think our Constitution is a dynamic one. It's one that stays up to date with timeless principles because the people make it so. But when the judges presume to take that role unto themselves, they are doing something contrary to the separation of powers. And I think if there's anything that the president has tried to do in selecting his nominees, and maybe he didn't hit it right with each and every one of them, we should have that debate and we should have that vote, is to select judges who will not presume to preempt the governing capacity, the dynamic governing capacity of the people themselves.
And Jack Beatty, on that rides an enormous tale to come.
Oh, yes, and a historic week coming up next week.
And not just a week, but it sounds like decades, maybe a century ahead, can turn on just that issue. Jack, wonderful to have you with us tonight. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Douglas Kamek at Pepperdine University, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Happy to be here.
And Jonathan Turley, George Washington University, wonderful to have you with us again. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.